Welcome to The Craft of Preaching, an online conference hosted by Luther Seminary, October 5th through 7th, 2020. This workshop by Andrew Root is titled Families, the Good Life, the Need for a Story, or Why Everything Else is More Important than Confirmation.
Hi, everyone. I hope you are having a good time. I had a good lunch. So, we're just going to talk for about, we're going to try to do this in 45 minutes and then have a good 15 minutes for conversation. And as I understand it, Tessa has told me we have kind of a firm end here at 2 o'clock. So we will definitely end that way. So let's jump in. I'm going to share my screen so you can see my slides. I hope this will be very kind of dialogical and conversational, like we're at a coffee shop together or something, as you're beamed into my dirty home office basement. But I do have some slides, and so which I always share when I go out to coffee with people. I always have a slide deck that I like to go through, so that'll feel just the exact same. But I'll share that, and just so you don't freak out, the first slide is just a blank black slide, so don't feel like you're not seeing them. You don't need to panic. So let me share these and we will jump in. All right. So I really want us to explore one big question. I mean, I think Tessa, in a very kind introduction, set us up well. But the real question I want us to explore, we'll definitely get into confirmation a little bit, but I really want to explore the big question, why is everything more important than church? And as we think, particularly in congregational life, why does it feel like families choose everything else instead of church? Or why does it always feel like church is the last thing chosen? So to get into that, I want to just share two stories with you that maybe will frame our conversation and in our discussion. It was a few years ago now, I was at a conference, and a young, just an almost out of college youth ministry major asked if she could have a coffee with me. And I figured that we were having coffee so that I could make my pitch on why she should go to seminary. So I was all prepared to be a good employee of Luther Seminary, a good member of the faculty, and recruit a new student for us. So we were talking, and I was, you know, giving my pitch on why I thought Luther was a good program, why I thought seminary education was great. And she stopped me and she said, yeah, I guess my bigger question is I'm not sure if I should do ministry at all. And then she shared that she had just finished a senior practicum where she was a intern, 6 to 10 hour a week intern at a church. And she said, you know, I don't know if ministry is really for me, because it just felt like parents were into so many other things and their kids were into so many other things, and that church really just wasn't their thing, and that they had all these other things that they were involved in, and that we just, you know, kept planning things and no one would come to them, or very few people would come. She's like, I don't begrudge parents for that. I mean, when I was in high school, gymnastics meant so much to me, and I was basically gone from church from October until our meet season was over in April. So I'm not mad about that, but I'm just not sure that I can make the impact I want to make in ministry. I actually think I'm thinking about maybe I should become a coach instead. So I want us to have that as one story as she thought about what does it mean that parents are drawn to so many other things other than getting to church. And then I did some interviews for families for a book that I was writing, and interviewed some folks who were really invested in their church and some people who were kind of invested here and there. And then I met a couple and their family who was not part of a church at all. And I met them through a friend who was connected with the basketball association here in the Twin Cities and said, well, you should talk to these people. So I went over to their house, and they were really interesting people, really great parents. I mean, it just took about 15 minutes of being with them to realize like they were way better parents than I ever was. And they probably hadn't been in a church in, I don't know, maybe 8-9 years. They had 3 daughters ranging from like 14 to 10. And basically it just took seconds for them to tell me that their whole lives really revolve around basketball, that all 3 girls were on pretty advanced travel teams, that their whole lives just from Monday through Friday in the fall and into the spring was just filled with basketball. They had a practice every night. And on the weekends, usually at least 2 of the girls were in a tournament, and that wasn't uncommon for them to have 5 games a day. And it was just, the dad even said, all we do in this family is basketball, laundry, and repeat. That's all we're really about. That's all we really, really do. So we were talking and about how important that was. And again, I was just really kind of taken aback by how committed they were to their kids. And they really were deeply invested parents. And they said at one point, the wife said, you know, I get it. It seems like we're just obsessed with basketball, but we're really not. We're open to our girls being involved in anything. She said, for instance, in the spring, our daughter's second sport is lacrosse. And our middle daughter said, well, I don't think I really want to play lacrosse this year. And we're like, well, that's fine. You don't have to play lacrosse, but what else do you think you want to do? And they said that the daughter said, well, actually, I don't want to do anything. And the mom was really clear with me. She said, that wasn't an option. In this family, we do something. We do things. She said, I don't care if it was a craft or what it was, but you have to do something. And I said, well, why is that so important? She says, well, it's really just important to us that our kids stay busy, stay off their phones, and most importantly, that they just find their thing. What's really important for us is that our kids find their thing. And this just kept popping up the more I talked to parents. The parents were really, whether they're very committed in church or not committed at all to going to a church, finding your thing was really central. And what framed the family often, especially when children were still in the home, was finding your thing. So I want to talk about this. What do I mean by a thing? And I think you're starting to kind of get the sense of this, that a thing usually is an activity that really directs the family's time. It's usually something that the kid is involved in, what one of the children is involved in. And usually the thing has a deep kind of investment of time. And I think overall, usually when we think of the thing, that the family, both the children as well as the parents, think it's good, that there's something inherently good about this thing. So by a thing, I mean, of course, you know, your sport, your test prep, your music and artistic activity, all these different things that young people and families really are centrally involved in. So I also don't think there's something more important than just that it's an activity, that it keeps them busy, that it provides some kind of resources. That usually I think what's even more important in our kind of cultural time is that this thing also is a structure that we tend to hang identity on, and also our sense of the good life. So there's a lot at stake in if a parent chooses to have their kid involved in swimming or in hockey, or if they choose to go to Wednesday night youth group, or they choose to take their kid across town to the best piano teacher that's in the state. Like, those things hold pretty significant value, not only because they're goods they want to give their kid, but there's also a sense that how the kid will answer the question, who am I, and how this sense what a good life is really wrapped around, or at least is hung on that. So let's look at these individually, and first start with identity and think about identity. Now, identity is a really important thing in our larger cultural context. Like, identity, I think, is a central kind of driving reality that we think to live well, you have to be able to answer the question for yourself, who am I? And so I think there's a lot at stake for parents and families when it comes to trying to articulate and help their children answer this question, who am I? But I think there's something about this that we tend to assume now that, and maybe this has changed over the last decade or so, but we tend for the most part to think how someone will find their identity, even construct their identity, and therefore answer this question, who am I, is basically for the most part an internal thing, that you somehow discover this yourself. So maybe at the ages of 11, 12, 13, 14, maybe one of our children goes to their room, maybe they watch some YouTube videos or something, but at some point they come out and they make an assertion, this is me. That they say, this is who I am, and they assert their identity. Now, I think what's happened kind of culturally over the last number of years, and I think this is actually a really good thing, I think this is a really advance for us culturally, is that we tend to deeply respect that reality. We deeply respect that everyone has a unique and original way to answer the question, who am I, for themselves. And again, I think that is a really valuable thing that we allow that kind of freedom. But we tend to assume then that to have a solid identity, you need to find find your own authentic way of asserting that. So we live in what Charles Taylor calls the age of authenticity. And inside of an age of authenticity, he says the real gain of this age is that you do have the freedom to articulate who you are and the experiences that make up who you are. But there also is a deep ethic that exists within that. So the age of authenticity is also coupled with the ethic of authenticity. And the ethic of authenticity says that no human being should tell another human being how they live their life. In other words, we should uphold the freedom for someone to define for themselves what it means for them to be them. Now, I say all that because inside this sense of identity, I think for parents, particularly these late modern parents who are in our churches right now, parenting is difficult in an age of authenticity. And you have to walk a very fine line because, of course, as a parent, you want to have some say and at least some kind of leadership and some kind of forming that you do around how your child answers the question, who am I? But you can't impose too much force. You can't impose too much torque in how your child defines who they are, because after all, that's unique in their own. And we know kind of culturally, and this is maybe for the most part true, but we kind of culturally hold that a bad parent is a parent who imposes their own ideas and their own wants and even their own identity constructions upon their child, that everyone needs to be free to discover this for themselves. But that puts a lot of pressure on parents because it shifts parenting, I think, and parenting becomes something more like cajoling, like you're encouraging, you're helping, and you're kind of standing alongside to try to help your child figure out who they are and discover who they are. So this internal drive becomes pretty significant. But it takes a certain kind of anxiety, I think, for a lot of parents. And this will kind of connect us to why the thing becomes so important. But if you think about it, and if you were to rewind even to the 80s, and I was telling people in the last presentation, one of the ways we've coped with the pandemic in my little neighborhood here, particularly with our neighbors next door who have kids the same age as my wife and I have, which we have a 16-year-old and a 13-year-old, is that we started to show movies in the backyard. We put up a screen, and I have an old projector we bring out, and we watch movies, and they sit in their yard and we sit in ours. And particularly in the early days of the pandemic, it was just a great way of social distancing and yet being together. But we decided that we needed a theme for these movie nights. So we decided to show old John Hughes movies, you know, from like the 1980s, which, first of all, I know like John Hughes wrote a movie like every 15 minutes, but like classic teen John Hughes movies from the 80s that some of us were raised on. Others of you don't remember any of John Hughes movies, and we all hate you for being so young compared to us. But I'm thinking of like movies like, Pretty in Pink and The Breakfast Club and movies like that. And our first movie we watched in our backyard was Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which I have to tell you is actually a much better movie than you remember. Our second movie was Pretty in Pink, which I have to tell you is a much, much worse movie than you remember. It's a terrible film. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, worth watching again. Pretty in Pink, they should burn it off of Amazon Prime forever. But we watched it in the third movie that we were going to get to that we never got to yet, but our kids really want to see it because we've talked it up so much. It's probably the most classic 80s John Hughes movies. His high school, Chicago high school movie is The Breakfast Club. And The Breakfast Club was so epic if you were conscious and alive during that time. One of the reasons it was so epic was because it was a day in detention, like Saturday detention, and there were, I can't remember, six kids there. But essentially, each one of the kids into detention for that Saturday represented an identity, represented a particular kind of middle-class identity you could be. So you could be the jock, or you could be the homecoming queen, or you could be the nerdy kid, or you could be the burnout, or you could be the kind of warped wrestler guy. Like you could pick all of these things that you could be, but those are basically it. So if you even go back a couple generations, there was a sense that there were only really 8 or 9 different identities you could be. But now I think inside this age of authenticity we exist within, there aren't 8 or 9 identities. And again, this is probably a good thing, but we actually think that there is an exponential amount of identities. Or maybe what we really believe is there is a unique identity for every individual. So that's a very different context in which to be parenting in, where you're actually trying to parent to help your kid find their most unique way of being them without putting too much pressure and directing them too hard that it becomes almost authoritarian, that you need to give them space to figure out who they are. So let me give you another kind of analogy that highlights this, and I have to be very careful because I mean this only in a certain way. But if you were to go back in the 80s and even in the 90s, and some of us who did youth ministry in like I did, like in the late 90s, and I want to underline it was the late 90s, so I don't seem as old as I feel. But if you did it in the late 90s, like bullying was just kind of part of it, and you hated it, and you tried to stop it, and you told those guys to stop picking on this guy or whatever, you told those girls to be nice to this girl. You really tried, but there was a deep kind of sense within the way we did sports and the way we did other extracurricular activities, the way school even happened, that bullying was just part of it. And I actually think, and again, I don't think this was good, I think this was a very bad thing, there was a kind of sense, particularly in, even in the 80s and the 70s, that bullying had a productive value to it. I think this was a lie, but it functioned. And the idea was there were only 7 or 8 identities you could be anyhow. So if you started to act too strange outside of those 7 or 8 identities, you got bullied onto one of those paths. And that was the supposed productive good of bullying. But now at my kids' school, like, bullying is zero tolerance. I think, I say this partly in jest, but I think you can get kicked out of school quicker for bullying than for, like, selling heroin. I'm not sure, but you see the kind of huge flip that goes on here. And I think that's a really good thing that we have zero tolerance about it, but it does have something to do with our sense that there really is, you can't bully somebody because whoever someone is isn't just a kind of identity that they fall into, but that's their unique, singular identity that is uniquely them. So we can't bully them. So this brings us this kind of sense of the thing, that the thing becomes so important, whether it's basketball or hockey or drama or volleyball, or just studying to get into a really good college or whatever kind of thing that this family is invested in and the young person's invested in, it becomes so important because we do really think that it becomes an essential way for parents to guide the identity construction of their kid. So maybe another way to highlight this is we all know played against sports, right? I think hopefully if you're from the Twin Cities, you know it, but I think it's around most cities in the United States. But played against sports is a sporting goods store, obviously, and you can clearly buy new things there. But mainly they sell used things. And it actually is a incredible service almost that they serve to middle-class parents who if you've ever gone to Played Against Sports, you know that you sell your sporting good equipment and you get, like, I don't know, like 10, 20 cents on the dollar. It really feels like you're getting ripped off, but most families are willing to do it because they just take your old crap. And really what Played Against Sports does is they harvest all of the failed, all the gear of the failed things. So the thing about the thing is that there's so many that don't work. So your 7-year-old, 8-year-old is involved in hockey for a while. Well, that doesn't stick. So you try basketball, but that doesn't work. But then you find out he's really into chess. So you join the chess club and you get really invested in chess. And now you're starting to drive across the states to be involved in chess. Well, what Played Against Sports allows you to do is back your car into your garage and throw all the crap that no longer is used. All the it really Played Against is a graveyard of failed things. So you throw the golf clubs that were used one time, that tennis racket that no one ever used, the skateboard that your kid begged you to get and then used it twice, and you get to haul it over to Played Against Sports, and at least you get like $50 for the $5,000 that you spent on all of this. So you see that the thing about the thing is that it doesn't, it's hit or miss, but it's the way that you can kind of guide your child and participate with them within this. So there's to give you a kind of theoretical basis for this, there's a really great book by a sociologist named Annette Laro, and she has this book is called Unequal Childhoods, and she really examines the difference between the way working class people and middle class people raise their kids, and it's very interesting how contrasting the parenting styles are. But what she calls middle class parents parenting style, she calls it cultivated. She calls it concerted cultivation, which is a kind of a mouthful, but if you get into it, you can see how this resonates with what I'm saying here, is that the way middle-class parents tend to parent their children is to be very concerted and try to cultivate something within them. So the thing becomes so important because it's a way that you can do concerted cultivation with your kids. So we can see that the thing becomes so important because of the way identity works, but there also is a way that getting involved in all these things, helping your kid find out the thing that they're really invested in, also, there's a sense that the good life is hung on it. Now, we have to say that being a human being is a strange operation, and it's a strange thing because as far as we know, we're the only animals. I mean, maybe dolphins and humpback whales are concerned about this, but it appears we're the only kind of animals who care that we're living a good life. Again, maybe dolphins care, but I don't know. But we know that for sure for us, we care about living a good life, that if... Actually, you can get woken up in the middle of the night, freaked out that you've made a couple bad decisions and you may be wasting your life. Like the thought of a life wasted, that you could waste your life, is just deeply, deeply anxiety filling for us. I mean, we have a whole a kind of phenomenon called the midlife crisis that really is a kind of wake-up call or a kind of fear that you've maybe wasted half of your life. And what do you do with that? It just becomes a deep existential burden. So we really do care that we're living a good life and we don't waste it. And we don't assume other animals. We don't even project that upon other animals. For instance, we never like say, oh, there's Max the beetle. Boy, has he wasted his life. You know what I mean? Like we would never say that. We'd never be like, oh, Max, there it is. 12 years of life. He spent most of them laying in a sunbeam, licking his own butt and chasing a tennis ball. Like what a wasted life. He could have done so much more with his life. We don't project that upon animals, but we do feel that very deeply. We feel the sense that we need to live a good life. And particularly as parents, we feel like we need to set up our kids for living a good life. And it stretches pretty deep. Like the way we talk, even this kind of moral vision gets embedded even in our language we use as we talk day to day. So those of you who have been to Luther Seminary know that there's a epic little store just down the hill from Luther called the Speedy Market, which those of us who live in the neighborhood show up at Speedy Market at least 4 or 5 times a week. You don't really live in the neighborhood unless you are there about 4 or 5 times a week grabbing something. And we always get our milk in there every week, and it's my job and my family to be the person who gets the milk. And this has happened to me. This is a confession to you that a few times, or maybe more than a few times, I've been in there and I've been getting my milk, and I take my cartons of milk to the counter, and usually it's a college-age kid behind the counter from the University of Minnesota, and he rings me up. And of course, after he rings up my last carton of milk, he says, so would you like paper or plastic? Now, I always say that I want plastic, but I'm deeply aware that those people who are, at least in my frame of reference, living a good life should know that plastic is not good for the environment, that plastic bags are showing up all over our oceans, that it's not good, that someone who's really trying to live a good life and who cares about the environment should get paper over plastic. So I find myself saying, as he says, would you like paper or plastic? I say, I'll take plastic because I use them with my dog. I pick up my dog's poop with those bags, as if he cares that I have a dog that poops a lot or whatever. But I feel almost impelled to tell him that I know that you shouldn't just get plastic bags for convenience, but that you should at least reuse them. But of course, what happens is he never really reacts most of the time. And so then I start to do my own moral acrobatics on him, where I start to think, whoa, wait a minute. Now, is he one of these kind of people who doesn't realize that it's important that you don't use plastic bags? Does he not care about the environment? He may have been thinking about something else, but I start to ask if he understands what it really means to live a good life. Like this deep sense of our moral kind of movements are really central to who we are. But now let's take this a step further and assume that I'm walking out of the door of Speedy Market and I see a neighbor. And my neighbor asks maybe even a deeper moral question. My neighbor asks, so hey, are your kids good? And how do I respond? I almost always respond by giving off examples of the things that my kids are involved in. So I say, oh, yeah, Owen's doing really well. I mean, he's working really hard on piano, and he had another recital, and it went really well. And his teacher thinks that, man, that he could maybe compete in this competition. And it's crazy that he wants to compete in this competition. And Maisie's doing really well, too. She's running cross country now. She just kind of started it out of the blue because she wanted to deal with the pandemic and be with some friends. And now she's really loving it. And we've really enjoyed going to her races. So we rehearse these activities that our kids are involved in. What I never say, and usually when I even rehearse that, I think I don't tell my neighbor about all the homework that isn't done and all the fights we've had over the last few weeks. I just rehearse all the activities that we're involved in, all the things and how they're involved in those. But I don't, which I maybe in a different moral consciousness I could have, and in a different time you would have. I don't say, yeah, things are going well. You know, Maisie's going through a time of penance and confession for sin right now. She's wearing a hair shirt to school when she goes to school, and you know it's pretty hard to do cross country in a hair shirt, but that's how you do penance for your sins. Or you know, Owen's in a time of real reflection and listening to the Spirit. I don't say those things. I talk about all the activities that they're involved in, which has this kind of sense of what makes for a good parent is that you're busy with your kid involved in so many other things. And this becomes a way kind of moving them into the good life. So let's imagine this question my neighbor asked me, your kid's good. What if the church asked this? Like, in some sense, I think we could get an idea of what we think about ministry or what we think ministry is to our children by answering this question, are our kids good? In other words, when our moral framework, how our moral framework shapes us, I think has direct impact on how we imagine what good practice is in ministry. So just give you examples. I mean, if we were to take a time machine and be in the 18th century in London, and we were to ask the church there, are the kids good? We would probably hear, no, they're not good. Or we're really worried. And they'd say, you know, industrialization has swept across England. The empire is a little bit in peril here. And we just see that all these young people are working in these factories. They can't read or write. And so we need something to change. So a ministry movement happens and we get the arrival of the Sunday school. Or if you were to go to the 19th century and ask in America, are the kids good? You'd probably get two different responses. You'd get one that would say, oh, we're not sure. They don't seem all that committed. So you get this thing that evolved called the Christian Endeavor Societies. Or you'd say, are the kids good? You might hear, we don't know. I mean, there's been a whole big movement towards urbanization and we're worried about our children. So you get the arrival of a new ministry form called the YMCA or the YWCA. But if we were to ask this after World War II or in the 1970s or 80s, or what we might even say, and we probably would put this in quotes, the heyday of youth ministry in the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s, are the kids good? We would probably get the response something like, yeah, they're okay, but I think they're growing up too fast. The real concern, I think, in the end of the 20th century was that our young people were just simply growing up too fast, that they had a lot of space and a lot of time. Maybe there was an after-school sport. Maybe you did a little homework. But for the most part, if you were a middle-class kid, you had a lot of time to just roam your neighborhood, to drive in your car, to hang out in a parking lot with your friends, to do all sorts of things you shouldn't do, like drive too fast and drink too much and smoke cigarettes and try to hook up with your girlfriend or boyfriend or a person you were attracted to. Like, there was all sorts of things that you could do that we really worried that they were taking on adult behaviors too quickly. To give you an example of this, which is a TV example, which are my best examples because that's my first major form of research, is watching a lot of TV. But if you just think of the Netflix show Stranger Things, which, you know, Stranger Things is a classic show. I think I just saw on the internet or something that they've started to shoot the new season, that they had to cancel or they had to put on hiatus because of the pandemic. They're reshooting it. So it's coming back. But if you've seen the show, if you haven't, you really should leave this Zoom room now and just start streaming the show. It would be worth your time. But it's a show that is a period piece. Like, it's based in 1983, I think. Somebody in the chat will correct me if I'm wrong. But it's like based in 83 in a suburban neighborhood. And it's also not only a period piece, but it's also shot like one of those like Spielberg early 80s movies, like Goonies or something. So it has like the double feel of being based in that time as well as feeling like one of those movies. But if you think about it just kind of as a phenomenology, like a cultural phenomenology, like the story just couldn't work if instead of it being 1983, if it was 2013, it couldn't work. I mean, Mikey couldn't be out in a junkyard fighting demigorgs in 2013 because he'd have traveling baseball and he just didn't have time. And between traveling baseball and making sure he had all his homework done, he would also have to be seeing his shot coach for his basketball team, and his mom would make sure that his Spanish lessons were going all right. Like, he just simply wouldn't have time to be roaming around his friends looking into a diabolical corporation that was opening up a third dimension and falling in love with one of these mystical girls from that dimension or wherever she was from. It just wouldn't work. And as a matter of fact, I mean, mom and dad too would be following him on their Find a Phone app, making sure that he wasn't in the junkyard and being very nervous about he was. So it has to be based in the 80s for it to work, because we really did think that what we were doing as good parents, and this is a picture of Mrs. Wheeler here, who's kind of a joke of the show because her and her husband basically don't know what their kids are doing at all. Like, they don't have any clue that there is a metaphysical child in living in the basement, and no idea that their kids are, you know, are fighting this corporation. She's just reading trashy novels and her husband's just sleeping on the chair. But in a real sense, that was what it meant to be a good 1980s parent. You just gave your kids free space, and with that free space, they grew up really quickly. Or to give you maybe a more edgy example, or maybe it just dates me further. Remember maybe the epic of all 80s teenage movies, Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Now you just have to take a moment and step back for a second and realize you can very rarely go to a lecture, for sure at a seminary, if not anywhere, where Fast Times at Ridgemont High is referenced. So I just feel like if there's like some kind of huge bingo card of things to reference, like this is a major win. But if you haven't seen this movie, you're too young. But, you know, this was like the epic 80s movie, which in many ways was, dare we say, like an anthropological, ethnographic piece of work. Because Cameron Crowe, who graduated early from high school, went back undercover to the San Diego High School and then had all these experiences for a year and then wrote this screenplay because of it. So it's not scientific, Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I would have to be a crazy super fan to say that, but it is kind of based in like site observation and ethnography in many ways. But if you rewatch this movie, it's crazy. Like, I rewatched it a year ago or something. Don't ask me why, but it was on and I started watching it. And one of the things you'll be amazed at if you rewatch it, if you take my challenge and watch Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you'll be amazed at how old the kids seem. And in many ways, in one way they are old. Like, the actors who are playing them are older than 15 to 18. You know, they're all like in their mid-20s. But just the situations and the kind of functional activities of the young people in the film, it just seems so much older than kids today. Like, for instance, there is only one time in the whole movie where parents are present. There's almost no adults in the film other than like teachers and others, but there's only one place where there are parents, and it's the first scene of the movie, which, if you remember this, that's not Stacy, I can't remember her name, the girl down on the bottom next to the guy in the sunglasses. She sneaks out of her house, and because she's lied about her age and set up a date with a guy who's like in his late 20s who sells stereo equipment at the mall. Yeah, because she's working. She meets him because she works in the pizza parlor at 15. Like, these are things that we just kind of don't do in our time. It feels like they're really, really old. And so we have this transition that I think that's gone on in the midst of this, where we've seen a flip, where maybe our issue, if you would have asked the church back in the 80s, 90s, the kids okay, they would have said they're growing up too fast. But I think what we've seen here is that there's a flip. And now it's not that they're not fast times anymore. We're not living in fast times with our young people anymore. But the times are much slower. They're not slower in the sense of busyness. They're even more busy than ever. But it seems like now the more parenting style is not necessarily a permissive one, like with Mrs. Wheeler and Stranger Things, but it's much more of a monitoring parenting style. To be a good parent now, you're really near your kids all the time. You're always with them. You go everywhere with them. You're driving them from one activity, from one thing to the next thing. You're pretty diligently involved. Of course, there's one area where you feel like you have no idea where they are, and that's in some kind of digital space that they slide into on their computer or on their phone, and that feels quite frightening. But for the most part, you kind of know where they are at all times, and they don't have a ton of time to be wandering around the neighborhood or driving and hanging out with their friends, because there's practice to get to, or there's rehearsal to get to, or there's ways you're trying to add to that college application to be able to get into a good school. So there's been this switch from this kind of permissive parenting to a more modern parenting. But we also, I think, in this time, especially for middle-class parents, we don't want to be overseeing our young people with authority. You know, like, there's monitoring, but monitoring as like prison guard doesn't seem very fun. So while there's been a deep sense of monitoring and participating with our young people, there's also been a transition to do that monitoring, or that monitoring can be done well if you do it as a friend. So there's been a huge transition where it's not very uncommon in my daughter and her six friends, if you were to ask them, or they would say, if you were to talk to them, like, my mom is my best friend. Which when I was in high school or middle school, if you would have said your mom is your best friend, you probably would have to transfer schools. You'd be ridiculed so much. But now it's really common. So we have the whole phenomenon of the Gilmore Girls, where we have Lorelai and Rory, who are best of friends. And again, that's a really beautiful thing. But it's a big kind of transition here, where we think quite differently about what it means to parent and what it means to lead our kids towards a good life. And so monitoring your kid by getting them involved in really a whole menu of things becomes significant. So the good parenting, or parenting as kind of monitoring presence, becomes about getting your kids involved in all sorts of a menu of things. So there's homework to be involved in, there's test prep, there's volleyball, there's debate club, and there's piano, and there's work, maybe there's work. There's soccer and cleaning your room and driver's ed and Netflix and relax. I'll make a confession to you, because I don't see the 30 of you on my screen and I'm just talking to a green light on my computer. But that used to say Netflix and chill. And this was the exact moment where I realized I was old, because I had a student come up to me and said, you know that Netflix and chill is actually a euphemism for hooking up, right? And I didn't know that. And that's when, at that exact moment, is when I realized that I was old. So, and then you need to sleep, and then you go to youth group, and then you walk the dog, and then you organize your sock drawer. So that these things become the kind of menu of these activities are how you parent. And so this kind of monitoring parenting with a menu of options then has led to even a more radical flip. And the more radical flip is that if we say this, and we say this broadly, we all know exceptions to the rule, but we can say that maybe broadly generationally, it appears, social scientists tell us, that compared to the 80s and the 90s, that young people aren't growing up too quickly now, but it may be quite the opposite, that they're growing up too slowly. So Jean Twenge has this quote from her book, which I'm going to have a hard time reading because some of your faces are in the way of it. But she says, contrary to the prevalent idea of children growing up faster than previous generations did, iGeners, or this new up-and-coming generation, are growing up more slowly. 13-year-olds now act like 15-year-olds used to, and 13-year-olds, or I don't know what the number was, I couldn't see it, than 13-year-olds used to. Teens are physically safer than ever, yet they are more mentally vulnerable. So this sense that she's seeing that there's a growing up too slowly. And one of the reasons that they maybe are growing up too slowly or not spending as much time, maybe thankfully, doing some of these things, is because parents are really present and giving them these menu of activities that can help guide their lives in a world where you can't impose too much on someone's identity, but you do want to give your kid every access to live a good life. Now, here's the issue with that menu of options, is that you may not want it to. You may not want to have to rank them like from 1 to 15 of the most important, but at some point you have to. Just as a finite human being, at some point they're going to conflict. And so you have to be able to rank them. And so the ranking happens. And usually the ranking looks something like homework, test prep, volleyball, debate club, piano, so on and so forth. And youth group or church gets lodged at number 12. And I think we've seen maybe over the last two decades that church involvement, confirmation, youth group, what have you, has just kind of continued to be pushed down the list. It's just been pushed further down. And I think as good church people invested in the life of the church, we somehow feel kind of compelled that we want to get it up the list. But I think it's really hard. And I guess I'm here to tell you that I think you will burn yourself out, and it is a near impossibility in our late modern time to think that the objective of ministry is to somehow maybe get from 12 up to 6, or from 6 up to 4, or something like that. I just think it's a nearly an impossible thing. And what makes it so impossible, or what leads to this ranking system, or how the ranking is done, are two different things that we probably don't have a ton of time to get into too much, but what I would call the AAA in the dream state. And this does take us deeply into thinking about what it means to live a good life. And one of the things that these theorists are telling us that I find very convincing and interesting is that for the most part in late modernity, we actually don't really know what it means to live a good life. And we for sure really don't know how to pass that on to the next generation about what's the content actually of the good life itself. But we do know that, and we do want all of our young people, all of our children to live a good life. But the best we can think of is that it will be whatever dream they want in the future. So we don't know what to tell them about what it means to live a good life right now, but we do want to give them as many resources and involvement in as many activities that they can have the resources to live whatever dream they want in the future. And so we start to make decisions by what's called this AAA, by what's called accessibility, availability, and attainability. What gives us more accessibility to resources, more attainability of things that can help us advance? What gives us more availability to the resources that can make our lives good? And these start to become the way we rank these things. So again, this is not, or I should say it this way, maybe I said it in the last presentation, that no parent does this equation before them. And no parent ranks these and says, well, which of these gives us more accessibility, availability, or attainability? But it's all kind of tacitly in the back of their head. But when the schedule comes, or when the Google Calendar alert comes that says soccer is the same night as the confirmation faith statement time, what they will do is the calculus in their mind, almost as a reflex, of what is better, or if we want to talk like a four-year-old, what is gooder, what holds more weight in the sense of the good life. And they will almost always do that equation by what has more accessibility, availability, and attainability of resources that can allow my kid to live whatever dream they want in the future. And it's just very hard to convince any parent. It's hard to convince any parent who is the pastor of the church, that it's more valuable, that there's more direct access to the good life by participating in Sunday school than playing in the third place Pee Wee B hockey game on Sunday morning. It just is hard to know. I mean, when you think of hockey, it's like, well, our kids will learn to work hard. They'll learn to work on a team. If they go to church, they'll be religiously literate, I guess. I mean, they'll be connected to people. I mean, they're people can name goods. They'll be connected to people. This is something that's important to us, and it's been important for generations. But it's hard to balance against these other realities. We could go a long way in talking about and unpacking this. For instance, like, we could just think like, okay, as we think of the whole system, who knows, the system could change post pandemic. But we think, wow, and when it comes to college, the price of college and university, if your kid wants to go to Yale, it'll cost $60,000 a year. If they want to go to Mankato, Minnesota State, I don't know the price, maybe $20,000 a year. And you think, well, is Yale 3 times better when it comes to teaching and learning than Mankato State? The truth of the matter is, when it comes to teaching and learning, when it comes to the depth of the professors, when it comes to texts that are read, there's no way it's 3 times better. But that's not what you pay for when you go to an Ivy League school. You don't pay for better teaching and learning. Maybe you get a little bit better, but that's not what you pay for. What you pay for, and what you work so hard to get into that school for, is that Yale has truckloads more of accessibility, availability, and attainability than those other schools have. So you go to that school for that reason. And you go to that school because if your kid gets a degree from Yale as opposed to Minnesota State, they have a chance of living their dream. Whatever dream, we don't know what that dream, whatever that good life might be in the future, we don't really know what that is. But if they have that degree, they have more opportunities to actually get there. And there's a lot of traps connected to that. But we can push, as we push this further and start to land this plane, I mean, confirmation is a really interesting case study because most parents in most congregations still think confirmation is important. Like, you talk to them in August, like, are you guys going to do confirmation this year? That's good. It's a good thing for their kids to be involved in. But when a calendar conflict occurs, confirmation almost always loses out. And the worst part about it is it loses out and it, and usually it doesn't feel like much of a conflict. It'd actually be helpful for you as a pastor if you had parents walking into your office sweating and like, oh my gosh, I just don't know what to do. There's volleyball tryouts and yet there's confirmation retreat. I just don't know which one to go to. Instead, you just get the call that says, we can't be at the confirmation retreat. We still want to be at confirmation Sunday in a few months, but you know, it's volleyball tryouts, so we have to miss them. So you can see how these things are kind of balanced and how these decisions are made. So how do we kind of land the plane here in our next 3 or 4 minutes? Well, I think that the best way to do that is to return to our conversation about identity. Remember we said that identity is assumed most often culturally, that it isn't an internal thing, that it is an internal feel, that you feel it, that you discover it within yourself, and then you present it to the world. I actually don't think that that's really true. And I think the best psychological theories as well as philosophical perspectives will say that's not really how identity is constructed. That my identity is never just an internal reality. That as a matter of fact, identity is always dialogical. It's always a conversation. You have an identity as you're in conversation with others. So for instance, which is a common thing that we say, like when you're in an identity crisis, the reason you find yourself in an identity crisis is because this dialogue that you've been having that's connected to stories and is connected to stories that you think make your life good, when you find that those are no longer true, or the stories you've been telling yourself about what makes your life good is no longer there, you find yourself in a deep identity crisis. So, of course, the movie example of this, the tragic independent film movie example of this is that, you know, you've had this story that you've been living out of, that your partner really loves you, and that you've been together for 10 years and your life is so meaningful together. And then you find out for 3 years, your partner's been having an affair, and you find yourself in an identity crisis. I mean, you didn't even do anything, but you feel like you've lost this sense of who you are, because the story you had of what made your life valuable and good and just the way you understood yourself through that narrative is all disappeared. So this takes us back to these basketball parents. And the thing about the basketball parents is they act like all the things are just equal. And their kid could pick anything. It could be crafts. It could be debate club. It could be chess. It could be basketball. But it's all open to whatever. But that's just really not true. The reason all those girls pick basketball and want to be so involved in basketball and find it interconnected with their identities is because basketball is a deeply narrated reality for those parents. Those parents actually fell in love around basketball, meeting at a basketball camp. And the girl's grandfather coached basketball for 30 years. And the girls could tell you stories about the first three-pointer they ever made and looking into the stands and seeing their grandfather jump up and down and saying to themselves as they ran back on defense, "I'm going to shoot 300 three-pointers a day." Like the sense of these narratives that form them, that you need a story. And I guess this lands the plane for us that can lead us into discussion here is that we keep thinking what we need to do is move our ministries, make church a thing that people will choose over other things. But I actually think that that plays at the rules of this kind of cultural reality that we shouldn't, that really what people need more than vibrant things that are able to compete within other things is what they need are deep forms of narrative and story. Now that still gives us a challenge of how do we stay present in people's lives enough with them. But I think what the onus is on is not thinking, man, how can we make our ministries electric and exciting and dynamic enough that it can compete with all these other things. Like if kids will get up at 4 a.m. for swim meet practice and for swim practice, they should get up at 4 a.m. to read their Bible or something. Like that equation just doesn't really work. But what really is significant and what the church does really offer our families and our young people are a deep way into the narratives that are rich. And, you know, like what in the Twin Cities, the Super Bowl, I think it was Super Bowl 53. And I think last year in the NFL, before this pandemic year, it was like the 100 years of the NFL. And you'd have all these like pictures, 100 years. And at one level, it feels like when we're doing ministry in this age, we feel like, man, we're nothing compared to the NFL. Like so many people skip church for their fantasy football team. But at another level, it's kind of cute and trite that the NFL has been around for 100 years, that it has 100 years of stories, where the church has been around and through its Jewish commitments and through Israel's history, been around for 6,000 years of stories and narratives that have formed us. So I think the invitation here is into being present enough with people, even out into the world, that we can narrate these deep experiences and help them see themselves as connected to a deep story. And what our young people need, I think, are these deep senses of narrative to interpret these stories, to indwell these stories. So a lot more to say, but I know we're at the 10-minute mark, and Tessa has been harvesting some questions. And so I'm going to stop sharing my screen and we can have about 10 minutes of conversation before our really hard stop.
Perfect. Thank you, Andy. Well, our first question comes from Carl, and this relates back to the unequal childhoods. Carl wants to know, are there differences that could be quickly described regarding class? So distinctive family life patterns.
Yeah, I mean, there are, and I would really recommend her book. But there's just a very different kind of, as she articulated it, and as I'm kind of trying to locate it here, there's just a very different pattern of much less, in a very good way, a kind of existential, almost fright, that your job is to cultivate all of these activities for your kid. And that there's less of a kind of breakneck acceleration that if you don't get your kid involved in that preschool at that time, then they're going to live a terrible, terrible life. There's a lot more, as she articulates it, a lot more kind of openness in the sense of just time. And that's not to idealize that situation either. There's sometimes too much free time, but the way time works is very interesting. So it's in less of a kind of accelerated sense of time and a different way of actually thinking about what is good. To just give another layer, again, not to idealize one over the other, but there is a sense that kind of place and commitment to neighborhood is more important for parents who are the kind of parenting practice of working class parents than often for suburban parents, I think is another thing she found.
Thanks for that, Andy. Our next question comes from Aubrey. So the image of young people caring for the environment is a false stereotype then. And is there no option for young people to work at the food bank or to do volunteer work?
Yeah, there absolutely is. But this becomes the difficult thing to kind of negotiate, is that the working at the food bank, volunteering, how that all works can easily become another thing amongst other things. And it can so quickly in the kind of neoliberal economic competitive environment we live in, it can become a way of competing for college admission. It can become a way of just asserting that you're a kind of enlightened person. But I think where we find real transformation, even in those activities, is when those things, and I think this is the onus on other older generations of people, when those kind of things like caring for the environment or working at the food bank is embedded in a much larger narrative than just it makes me feel good or it's going to look great on my my college application. But there's a deeper moral sense of where this rests within what it means to be living a good life. What does it mean to be flourishing, but not just flourishing as an individual, but for instance, the world and the environment to flourish? What does it mean to actually care for your neighbor? So this becomes part of the issue, and it's really difficult, I think, in late modernity, that even these best of impulses can easily be taken up into certain kind of competitive growth accelerations that, I mean, we said this in the last presentation, that this has becomes one of the huge issues. And I think I should have looked up the name of this in between the presentations, but there's a new podcast that's out with in the New York Times kind of podcasting network. And it's about looking at middle-class parents who are absolutely, at least as a kind of ideological perspective, committed to equity and the need to be rethinking equity. But that rethinking of equity also means that some of the advantages their own children have to be sacrificed. So their really good schools that their kids are part of, they may have to lose resources so that other people can have them. And the kind of double bind that puts in, because as a pure idea, that's what they want. But there's a completely different kind of functioning inside of actually having to sacrifice some of that yourself. So, I mean, this is what I said in the last presentation, but it just seems quite naive that just simply secular frameworks that are all about accruing resources and accelerating to get more could somehow lead to some of that. But there has to be, I guess I would say in some ways, that there has to be deeper narratives that include transcendence and transformation to get to some of that, I think.
Perfect. Thank you, Andy. Janet wants to know, are there ways to help young people connect with the stories while recognizing that for many or most, confirmation and membership of the institutional church is less and less important.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I wish we had more time because we'd spend more time kind of dwelling in that. I just tried to answer for you the one question, why everything's more important than church, but there's much more work that needs to be done on the other side of that. But I absolutely think that's right on, that the institutional church or membership in an institutional collective or group it's hard to understand how that has a lot of vibrancy. And so I just think what actually leads to commitment or a deep sense of meaning inside of these institutional structures are the experience of the community of narratives and stories. So I think a big move is, how do we expose our children to more and more stories? And at first it starts with, as parents, how do we tell our own children what we think makes a life good and leads to a good life? And then how do they hear from within the congregation these deep narratives of the encounter with the living God? So I don't think that, I think it will only be from these experiences of persons in relationship that will always be held together in some way by narratives that that they'll see some vibrancy and some reason to stay involved.
Thanks, Andy. And then Renee wants to know, can you suggest resources for talking to parents about this to help them understand the necessity for the deep formative narratives as opposed to just more activities?
Yeah, so it is a huge challenge. So a resource that, I mean, this is like the ugly plug of the presentation, but my new book, The End of Youth Ministry with a Question Mark, we'll get into this, and the subtitle is Why Parents Don't Care About Youth Groups and What Youth Workers Should Do About It, I think, which is seems much more practical than maybe the book is, but that's somewhere to look. But there's been a lot of other stuff, and if I can't remember who asked the question, but if you email me, I can point you to some other kind of more practical places to look for some of that when it comes to those stories. But that book would get at a little bit of these dynamics that are going on.
Renee, if you want to send me your email privately, we can make sure to hook you up with Andy and get that going. And then we'll close with Lee's question. How do we make space for children and youth to share their own stories in a safe environment?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think first of all, well, I'll say two things. One is that when we talk about sharing our stories, we do have to have, I think, and this is if we just had more time, we could get into this, but a deeper theological imagination of what the story actually does. And by that, what I mean is it's not just a kind of performative element of hearing a story, but there's a sense in sharing in someone's story, we're actually taken up into, I think, a deep connection with that person. And there's something transformational that happens in that. And that the story then kind of takes the shape, even, I think, of Jesus' own story of his life, death, and resurrection. And that becomes a kind of transformational dynamic. But really practically, I do not think it's appropriate or quite simply will work to ask a 12-year-old or for that reason, a 22-year-old, you can't just like look at them and say, well, tell me your story. What's your story? Tell a story right now. Like most of us just, our brains don't function that way. And you both learn to tell a story or even feel the invitation to tell a story by hearing a lot of stories. So I think how we create the environment where they feel safe to do it is by giving them the absolute freedom to hear a bunch of stories. So the onus is really on us. And I think as people who are in kind of paid kind of official ministry roles is to create environments for that to happen. And for our young people, it starts by actually, I mean, I say this somewhat, I overstate this to make the point, but I kind of believe it too. Part of your job is to ordain people into presenting these stories. So as we think of kind of a craft of preaching, in some sense, you know, you're thinking about how you preach in the pulpit, but it's also how you allow, you know, the saints of the church to preach their own narratives of their encounters with the presence and absence of Jesus Christ to the community, and how the community dwells in those stories and tries to interpret those stories and make sense of those stories. And if we had longer, I mean, we could talk, but I think the kind of stories that young people need to hear is not just things were really bad, now things are really great, you know, thank Jesus, as much as they need to also hear stories of people still in process. I don't know. I'm in doubt as much as I am in faith in this moment.